Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking a little bit about object files and linking. First, let's go over what we talked about last time, which was mostly logistics. Also reviewed how processors and memory work. So remember, processor is this thing which does our computation, which talks to a memory and also I/O devices like keyboards. And the basic protocol we learned that it uses is it sends addresses, possibly along with the value to put in that address, to memory and I/O devices, and it gets back values. And how those values are interpreted depends on what the processor is doing. The processor is looking for an instruction to run, it's going to interpret that value as machine code. If it's running a move instruction that writes a value to a register, it's going to interpret that value as an integer. So that's all what varies based on what the processor is trying to do, but the basic idea is the processor is this machine which just talks to these other devices by sending addresses, numbers that are typically indexes into this array of data, and getting back values or putting in new values. We also talked about endianness, this idea that, well, when we have something like memory, each byte in memory has an address, and we want to know, well, if I have a value which is bigger than a byte, how is that stored in multiple bytes? And we have these two conventions, and the one we're using in this class is little endian means the least address stores the least significant part of the value. So in the case of this hexadecimal integer here, 3-4 is the least significant part. It's the part which matters least. It's going to be stored at the least address, the part with the lowest number. That's the rule for little endian, the rule we use in this course. The alternative is big endian, where that would be stored at the other end, it would be stored at the highest address. And the least address would have the most significant part, the 1-2 part in this case. And we talked about object files and linking. So this is the idea that you learned in 2150 that you can compile your C++ programs a file at a time and then put them all together later on. We have these intermediate files called object files, and those contain the machine code generated for all those functions, but we don't have everything we need to produce the actual executable. We need to know, for example, how do we call a function in another file, and when we're producing the object file, we can't know, well, where is that other function? So we have these relocations, which are fill in the blanks to fix up that call of that function, for example, to have the correct final address when we figure out where is the function going, which we only know when we see the file which implements the function. And we have this symbol table, which is the information when we have that file to know, oh, this file contains printf. So we know, where what relocations are affected by that file. So any questions on any of these topics from last time? Okay, so a brief logistic note. If you are on the wait list, which is less likely in this lecture, then there are labs and lectures open. And you should fix that because we're of the opinion that if we haven't heard from you, you probably don't have a problem. If you, for some reason, cannot register for the 2 p.m. lecture, even though you're here, we should talk. You might be able to do something about that. If you, there are labs which are open, you should be able to find plenty of labs which have a few extra seats. If you have a problem and you need this course, let me know. And a brief diversion into anonymous feedback. So I don't think I mentioned it last time. There is anonymous feedback on Colab on the side. I read it. I appreciate it, especially if you will tell me specific things like, gosh, that thing about processors and the I/O bridge was really confusing because I don't know what any of those things are. And this is probably mostly because I didn't actually know how 2150 covers this stuff and thought it was closer to that picture than it was. That's useful stuff for me to know. If you want to use anonymous feedback to just tell me the assignment is bad without even specifying what assignment you're talking about, that's also fine. I'll take whatever I can get. Do you use and pay attention to this? I might occasionally show some anonymous feedback, might not. I'll try to use judgment on that. But it's actually anonymous too, so if you tell me you graded something, I graded something wrong, I can't fix it, I don't know who you are. Okay. Any questions about logistics? Great. So last time we were talking about linking with our relocations or fill in the blanks and our symbol tables to know where the labels are that might be things that the blanks are filled in with. And this idea that we produce this executable by filling in all those blanks and deciding where everything goes in memory. And I'm going to tell you now why this isn't quite right. But this is the basic idea, is that we produce this executable by concatenating all our machine code, all our data, and filling in all the relocations so that call, in this case, to puts actually calls puts and doesn't call a null pointer and crash. Which we can only do when we know where does puts end up, which we can only know when we look at where is puts in standard IOTA now. So we get this executable image, and the idea is that the operating system can just load this into the appropriate place in memory, and that's it. There's no extra work to do besides jumping to the first instruction to run. Linking does all the other work, and that's nice and easy. And this is something that can actually happen, but the things are a little more complicated on modern systems, and there's sort of two big details I'm omitting. So first, any questions on anything from this picture before I add things? Yes?
So why is the listener LSTR highlighting the boiling point, all zeros, if all the data, hello world is just the data?
So the question is, why do I have this, have Elster highlighted in blue here and here and here? So. Yeah, so we have the string, which is data. And when we lay out our executable, we're going to put all the machine code together, followed by all the data. And what we want this instruction here to do is to load the address of the string into a register. And the way we're going to encode that is we're going to have the address of the string in the instruction.
So we don't know where hello world ultimately.
Yes, and we don't know, because we don't know how much stuff there's going to be before the data, where hello world will be in memory. So we have to have a relocation, so the linker will figure out, oh, standard IO is this big, therefore hello world ends up this many bytes later, and then it's going to fill in that address in the move instruction. So our move instruction actually moves the correct address into RDI. So any other questions about this? So the two details is that I gave you the impression that we just fill in addresses. We have these slots where we put in an address. Some machine code doesn't use addresses as is. They expect something not just a raw address, but they expect something related to an address. So a common example is that there's a form of the call instruction on x86, which says, I want you to call not a particular address, but I want you to call something so many bytes away from me. So you would say, call the function that's 4,303 bytes later in the program. And the relocation would not fill in an address, but would fill in that 4,303. We still don't know that when we're producing the object file, because we don't know where puts is relative to main. So we still need the relocation and the linker to do that, but it's not filling in an address, it's filling in something it needs the addresses to compute. And the linker will do this kind of commutation all the time. And we'll have an extra thing in our table of relocation saying, I need the address of puts, and by the way, I need it to be not the absolute address, but subtract the current address from it. And we'll have that sort of information in the object file based on what type of hole we're filling, whether it's for a move instruction where we're going to put in the absolute address or a call instruction where we're not. So the other big detail I'm missing is that I implied that we do all this work when we produce the executable file. And that is a real thing that is often done, and it is called static linking. But on most of your systems, the default is something called dynamic linking, which means that some of this work is done when we produce the executable, and some of it is left over to do when we start the program. So we do part of the linking to produce the executable, but leave a little left over when we start the program. And the main idea of this is that, you know, I have like 1,000 executables on my laptop that all probably use printf. And it sure would be nice to not have 1,000 copies of printf on my laptop. It also sure would be nice if when I fix a bug in printf, I don't need to recompile 1,000 programs and relink them. And so to let that happen, we do this linking at runtime where we load the copy of printf at runtime for all these executables and don't store it as part of the executable. So this is typically the default on most of your systems, is that things like the C standard library, those stuff will be dynamically linked, so there's only one copy of it on the system. And that means there's some part of that, this linking, this filling in those relocations that happens when the application loaded, whatever can't be done when we produce the executable. So like for functions within your executable, those will be linked when the executable is produced, but for things that are in this shared library, they won't be. You can, however, explicitly request the statically linked version with the compiler we use. You just pass the minus static option when you produce an executable, and it won't do any of this dynamic linking stuff. It will give you an executable which has printf inside of it. When you see dynamic linking, like you might see in the BOM homework, there's often a bit of extra indirection. So a common thing to do is to have a table of functions and have like an entry in there for printf and only replace that entry. And every time you call printf, we actually look up in the table where the address of printf. The reason to do this is that the linker now needs to fill in one thing instead of, say, all the 10,000 calls to printf in your program. So it makes starting the application faster, even though running printf is very, very, very slightly slower. So this is most commonly what you'll see done in a dynamically linked executable. There'll be a little extra indirection just to make it fast. It's not necessary. There are real systems where they don't do this, but most commonly they really care about applications starting up quickly and not needing to change lots and lots of places in the code. So any questions about dynamic linking? Yeah?
You said then call it to the function table. Is that part occur when at the same time that static linking would occur?
The question is, when is this calling into the function table code created?
Yes.
Yeah, so that is created typically, yeah, at the time static linking would normally occur, like when we produce the executable or possibly when we produce the object files, that sort of code is generated. And the table is filled in when we start the program. So you might see this, you might not, if you look very, very carefully at your BOM that you get for the BOM homework. This is what happens, and it's just for efficiency. We could actually replace all the calls to go to the real printf function, let's say. Other questions on dynamic linking? Okay. So dynamic linking is the default and is used most of the time because we don't like having all our executables being several hundred kilobytes. So for example, on my laptop, binos, the list the directory program, is a dynamically linked executable. And there's this tool called LDD on Linux, which shows you what dynamically linked libraries a program uses. So in this case, before the arrow is the name of the library, after the arrow is the place on disk where, if I run it, it will be loaded from. And in the parentheses is the address in memory in which it will be loaded. So you can see that binos, which you probably thought was a really simple program, which, gosh, doesn't need very much, in fact loads a whole bunch of libraries that it's dynamically linked to when you start it. So any questions on this? Okay. So that's conclusion of talking about linking. So our next topic is going to be about assembly. So in particular, I'm going to focus on things that you either didn't learn in 2150 or probably don't remember from 2150. And we're going to start out by talking about syntax. So in this class, our textbook uses AT&T Syntax Assembly, When you do the BOM homework, the tools you're using will default to AT&T syntax, since that's the normal thing to do on Unix. Now, for the BOM homework, it is possible, and we have instructions, if you read carefully in the lab write-up, for getting Intel syntax assembly out of the debugger, out of object dump, and every tool we give you. So if you're more comfortable with that, feel free to do it. But later on in this course, when I show slides, when we have you implement your own processor in a hardware description language, we're going to be using AT&T syntax assembly, so you probably should be used to it. So let's give a simple example of what AT&T syntax looks like with some equivalent Intel syntax. So here, this is a move the value 42 in decimal into memory, where the memory location is based on the value in RBX. The address in memory is the value in RBX. So in Intel syntax, we put keyword pointer RBX as where we're moving to, and then 42. In AT&T syntax, you notice that a lot of things are different, starting with the order, and we have this funny line noise dollar sign, there's this weird Q, there's these parentheses, there's no pointer or anything like that, so we'll talk about what all this means. So the basic rules. In AT&T syntax, the destination is always last. So you can read this as move 42 into RBX. If you think about instructions as into, that will help you remember where they're going. So the destination is always last. And the parentheses mean that this is referring to a value in memory based on that register. So in this case, it's the value in memory at the address in RBX. Dollar signs are used to start constants. If you don't have a dollar sign, it is not a constant, it is an address, as we'll talk about later. So the dollar sign is needed to say I'm moving the constant 42. Otherwise, I'm saying I'm moving the value at address 42 into another address, which is not an instruction that exists. All registers are going to start with percent signs. If you do not have a percent sign, it's not a register, it's a label. We have this postfix. In this case, we have a Q. The Q indicates the length this instruction operates on. So in this case, Q stands for 8 bytes. The name comes from this being based on 16 bits being the normal size, 2 bytes. So Q is for quad, 4 times 2, 8 bytes. We also have L for long, which is 32 bits, or 4 bytes. W for word, which is 2 bytes. And B for byte, which is 1 byte. So often, you can omit this Q, L, W, or B. The cases where you can do that are where it's unambiguous from the arguments what the size is. This is not one of those cases, because if I change this move Q to a move L, that's a real instruction that does something different. That's moving 32 bits into memory that has the value 42 instead of 64 bits that has the value 42 into memory. They're both valid instructions, and they write different things to memory. And we tell which one we're referring to by adding the Q.
Wait, is that referring to the value of 42?
It's the size of operands the instruction acts on. So in which case, this is the size of value being moved. Well, you can use this postfix on any instruction. So like, you'll see it on push. That means we're pushing a 64-bit value. You'll see it on pop. You'll see it on like add, and so on. The size of the value the instruction acts on, it doesn't have anything to do with the size of the addresses being used to access memory. That's always 64 bits.
If you omit the Q here, what?
So the question is, what happens if I omit the Q? If you omit the Q, I believe, I haven't tested, what happens is that the assembler gives you an error message. It says, I don't know what size you mean. I can't just figure out what instruction to write into the machine code. Yes. So what happens if I remove the dollar sign? So if you remove the dollar sign, as we'll discuss later, you're asking the assembler to move a value from the address 42 into the value, into the address specified by the value of RBX. And that is not a type of move instruction that exists on x86, so I believe you will get an error about that. Yes?
Can you give an example where it's unambiguous so you don't need the queue?
Give you an example where it's unambiguous so you don't need the queue. So for a comparison. So the one example would be if I'm adding two values, bx, I can also write add rax rbx because I know rbx and rax are 64-bit registers. Other questions? Yeah.
The constants versus addresses, are we still doing constants are in decimal and addresses are in hex?
So the question is for constants versus addresses, are we still doing constants are in decimal, addresses are in hex? No. The way it works is that if you don't have an OX, it's decimal. If you have an OX, it's hex, but the assembler does not care whether you use decimal or hexadecimal as far as whether it's a constant or address. Okay. The only way it knows is whether you use a dollar sign or not. Like, it will allow you to write, even though it doesn't make any sense to do so, like, write a giant decimal number as your address. And it will also allow you to write a hexadecimal number as a constant. And we'll commonly see that. Other questions? Okay, so this is the simple memory access instructions. And probably the most daunting thing about AT&T syntax is how it represents the more complex way Intel lets you address memory in an x86 instruction. So here we have the most complex way of addressing memory we will talk about in this class, which is that we have a base register plus an index register times a small constant plus an offset. And this is how probably what you're used to from Intel syntax assembly. And this is how that appears in AT&T syntax. So the offset appears as a number before the parentheses. Even though it is before the parentheses, it is part of used to compute the address. So don't think of the parentheses as an access memory operator, because we compute the address of using the things before the parentheses too. The base register appears first, followed by a comma, followed by the index register, followed by our scale factor, which in this case is 4. Just like in Intel syntax, you're limited in the choices here. Most notably, the scale factor can only be 1, 2, 4, or 8. And so you should just memorize how this mapping works, because it comes up a lot. So any questions about this?
Can you repeat scale lengths?
What? What this? So we have our offset. That's the thing we add to the address at the end. We have our base register, which we don't multiply by anything. We have our index register, which gets added and multiplied by the scale. And we have the scale that we multiply by. Other questions?
So we need to know like the pseudo C stuff, is that like
important? I mean, that's the same information that's in the Intel syntax. But that's, I think, the best explanation of what's happening. Right. That's the computation we're doing. So this is the full form, and AT&T syntax also allows a bunch of abbreviations. So you can omit all but the last two fields. At the index register and the scale, and you just have a base register. You can omit, you can have only a register and a scale, in which case that register is the index register, since it wouldn't make sense to have one register and a scale and not multiply by the scale. In which case, so that's the index register, and the base register is substituted for 0. You can explicitly do that by having a comma to there. If you don't specify a register, it defaults to the value 0. If you don't specify a scale, it defaults to the value 1. Also, I mentioned that if you don't have a dollar sign, it means the place in memory, and that's just a generalization of this syntax. If we omit all the things in parentheses, we get the address 100. Also, as a notable special case, so if you omit the scale, it's 1. So if you don't have a scale, you just have 2 registers, base plus index, index times 1. It's just base plus index. Is there any question about any of these? Yeah?
That last one isn't RBX plus R6 plus 100?
Yes, it is. So that is an error on the slide. Less 100. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Is there any way to omit the offset, or would you just type?
The question is, can you omit the offset? Yes.
Okay.
So you obviously can't omit it in this case.
Right.
But in all the other cases, you can omit it, and it defaults to 0. Other questions? Yeah, and we saw an example of that at the first move. Yeah.
So in general, what is the offset used for?
The offset is added to compute the address after we use all the registers.
So like in an array, after.
So your question is like, why is this a useful thing to have in the assembly language? It's the same thing as if it were, why isn't it added to the index before we multiply?
Yeah.
This is a choice that they made. I believe it makes the hardware simpler to do this. And generally, if you can just scale the offset by whatever your scale factor is manually, and this is what compilers will do. So like if you ask a compiler, so if a compiler needs to do that sort of thing, it just will do it for you, and people aren't too concerned about that it being convenient to program assembly, so I don't think that's why they don't care about making it more easier to index arrays with it. Yes?
What are the choices for scale? You said there were only a couple.
The choices for scale? What are the choices for scale? The choices for scale are 1, 2, 4, and 8. If you try anything else, you will just get an error because there's no machine code for it. Yes? Question is, do the registers need to be in the first two? What do you mean by the first two? Here? So are you asking, I'm not sure what you're...
You have the opposite, right? Like, is there anything stopping you from putting it between two registers?
Putting the scale between two registers?
Yeah.
Yes, you are not. The scale must be the last part. The order, you have to keep the order. You can only omit things, is the way you should think about it. All these things that are shorter are just omitting parts, but the order always stays the same. Okay, other questions? Okay, so another notable thing about AT&T syntax, which is technically a consequence of something I told you before, but not an obvious one, is that because the destination is last, and the subtract instruction is still the same instruction, it maybe doesn't do what you expect. So you should probably read subtract as subtract from. Subtract RAX from R8. Because R8 is the destination register, and it's the same subtract instruction. And the same applies to comparisons. Because comparisons, as we'll talk about a little later, actually do this subtraction internally. So this is something that trips a lot of people up that you just need to know. This is the order in which subtracts work, because the operands are reversed from what you've seen in Intel syntax. Any questions on this? Okay. So I mentioned earlier that you need a dollar sign to represent an address. So this is a direct example of that also with hexadecimal numbers as a constant versus an address. So the first one reads memory at address hex 1000 and adds what it reads into RAX. Second one of these adds the value hex 1000 to RAX. These are both valid, both things you can write. You probably want to make sure you know which one you mean. And here's my one slide summary. So any questions about any of this? I have one more minor thing about AT&T syntax to talk about, but any about these major points? Okay. Yes? The question, are the parentheses just used for when we're, for?
You don't have them around using like constant.
Yes, yes. So the parentheses we only need when we're using a register value to compute an address. So they represent using a register value to compute an address instead of as a direct value. And you can think of the raw address as just being like, we're just omitting both of the registers in the scale. And therefore, we don't even need the parentheses. So you can think of that as being what's going on. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So one minor additional note on computed jumps. So computed jumps have this weird asterisk, and that's what in AT&T syntax to represent them, that you might see when you're disassembling your BOM. We're not going to test you on this, but we'd like you to have seen it so you're not confused when you see it in the debugger. So this first example here means REX contains an address. I would like you to set the program counter to that address. Just go to the value stored in REX, to the address stored in REX. And that has a dollar sign and certain asterisks in AT&T syntax to represent that we aren't like executing code inside REX itself. And for some reason, they chose this way of representing that. So the second version says that I want you to get an address by accessing memory in this way. So this reads memory at REX plus RBX times 8 plus 1000. And expects that memory address to contain the location of machine code. It's not machine code itself, it contains the location of machine code. So usually what this means is there's a table of locations of machine code, of like functions, and we're doing a lookup in that. And given that location, then we jump to it. That's what this instruction does. Yeah?
So the first one checks the value of that register, then jumps to wherever that would be.
The first one checks the
first of those two, it checks the value in the register.
Yeah, so it reads the value in the register and just sets the program counter to it.
Okay. The second one checks that place memory and sets whatever value.
It read place. Yes. The second one is more indirect. It reads from that place in memory in order to figure out where to go. Yeah.
Sorry, so you said the second one takes item stored at that part,
and
memory interprets that as an address to set the program counter
to? Yes. So like it moves that address value into the program counter. And the first one moves REX into the program counter, basically. So basically both of these move the value specified after the star into the program counter.
What is the star?
The star just represents it's indirect. I believe, I'm not sure the exact reason AT&T syntax decided to do this. I believe the justification is that they imagine if they just wrote jump Q REX, that you'd think that would mean we're executing machine code inside the REX register. And they're saying that we're using that as an address to go to.
Star is only used for jumps?
Only used for jumps, yes. And calls and other control flow. So you might see a call that looks like this, which means call using a function pointer. OK, so that's my last bit of AT&T syntax. So now it's for some talk about things that about an assembly that may have been undercovered in 2150. First, some review. So hopefully you remember that there are a bunch of registers. We'll talk about RIP later, which is not really a general purpose register. But there's a bunch of registers, and we have these overlapping registers. So we have RAX is a 64-bit register, and EAX is a name for the bottom 32 bits of it. And AX is a name for the bottom 16 bits of it, and AL and AH are names for each of the halves of of AX. And the same is true for RBX, RCX, all the way up to R15. The names of the parts are different. But there's this way of naming parts of registers and acting like they're whole registers. And yet, presumably, you vaguely remember this from 2150. So one note is, how do these overlapping registers actually work? That's a good thing to know. And the rules are a bit strange. So for a 32-bit register, so if I set EAX, that sets the rest of the RAX register, the top bits, to zeros every time. That's just the rule. If you set EAX, you set all of RAX, just the top 32 bits are all set to zeros. And I'm mentioning this mainly because when you disassemble your BOM, you'll commonly see compilers taking advantage of this. And you might be really confused as to what about the top bits? What if I entered a really big value? What would happen? And the answer is, well, they're being cleared, so it doesn't matter. However, this is not true with the 8 or 16-bit registers. So if you set AL or AX, that does not clear the rest of the 64-bit register. You won't very often see the compiler generate code that does this, but that's not what happens. In that case, you just set those bits as you probably would have guessed. Okay. Any questions on this? Fair enough. So just an arbitrary rule, mainly because the decisions about what to do about these registers were made at different times.
The naming conventions for addressing the smaller parts of the registers, like 32-bit part.
Is that consistent? Well, you can judge for yourself. Kind of. This figure also appears in some form in a slightly different form in your textbook, so you don't need to memorize this. But yeah, it's kind of consistent, but not fully. There are some like weird cases like BPL versus SIL versus R13B. Yeah, it's not designed from the top down. Okay. Other note is about labels. So labels in assembly represent addresses. They are always addresses, which remember are numbers. Those numbers that happen to be an index into memory. And they act exactly like numbers. So they're as if you had that constant there, except the constant you know is filled in later on producing the program. But they act like the number in assembly. So let's say string ends up at address 1000. This is going to act like we wrote add 0x1000 RAX. This is going to act like we wrote add $0x1000 RAX. So that means the first one is going to read from where the string as an 8-byte number and add that 8-byte number to RAX, which probably wouldn't be something you intended to do. But it's valid and will do something that's well defined. The second one will take the address of the string, because the label represents the address, and the dollar sign says we're treating it as a constant, not as a place to access memory at. Take the address of the string and add it into RAX. That's kind of actually useful. So let's say RAX contains 2. That would then make RAX point to the address of S. The second character of the string, 2 bytes into the string. But it's just like we had figured out where the string would go and replaced every instance of the label with the address like as a hexadecimal number. And this rule holds in true like for a move instruction. So like if you do move q dollar, that moves the address. If you do move q no dollar, that copies 8 bytes from that address from the beginning of the string into a register. Same sort of idea. So any questions on this? We're, yeah, so, yeah. Question is, do you have to declare a label or not? So here, well, we declared a label in a sense by having string. When you use an undefined label, usually that will end up just appearing in the relocation table of the object file you produce. And it will just be a question of, does the linker find something that has the same name? There are ways of explicitly declaring labels. I'm not actually sure how often that's necessary to do. The usual thing is that if you use a name, the name appears in the object file, and the linker sees all the names. It sees the names in the symbol table of labels that are actually defined, and it sees the names in the relocations of labels that are used, and it can try to figure out what's happened.
Started using labels by that
segment
where you label colon and then what it corresponds to.
Yeah. So having label colon says I want you when you generate this object file to say that this label is here. Yeah. Okay. This label has the address of wherever in this case that string is. If you put it before an instruction, it has the address of wherever the machine code for that instruction is. Other questions? So that's on labels. And related to accessing memory, I'd like to talk about what is probably the most confusing instruction people we deal with in this class, which is load effective address, which I think you've kind of seen in 2150 and almost certainly didn't understand based on what I've seen in this class before. So the syntax for load effective address looks like a move from memory. But it skips the memory address. So it does all the work you would do to access memory, to figure out where you access memory. And then instead of reading memory, it just takes that address it computed where it would have accessed memory and shoves it in its destination register. So for example, we have here LEA four parentheses REX into REX. So here, if this were a move, we'd be accessing at memory of at 4 plus the value in REX. That would be the address at which we access memory. But we're going to stop there and just use that address, 4 plus REX, and put it in REX. So this instruction has almost the same effect as adding 4, add Q, constant 4, REX. You can think of it as sort of, you know, like the ampersand operator on the first value. Yes?
What do you say almost
the same effect? So we'll discuss later an example of how it differs. But yes, there's a functional difference which you can notice in your code between these two, besides the machine code encoding, of course. So any questions on what's going on here? So this is handy because the processor has implemented the machine array to compute addresses efficiently, and it can actually do math that's inconvenient to do with the other instructions. And I'll give some examples of that in a second. So one example here is, let's say we want to multiply a value in REX times 5. Well, that's REX times 4 plus REX. And we can represent that as an address computation. So that's one instruction that's going to be, yeah?
We can represent that as a what?
Address computation like this. So that's one instruction. And compilers really will generate this. It's faster than doing a multiply by a constant on most processors. and it's nice, one convenient instruction. And note that because we never actually access memory, it doesn't matter if REX times 5 is a valid address. So you'll commonly see this sort of code generated when it doesn't make any sense whatsoever to interpret REX as an address. Like REX might be like 2. Like if you access memory at 2, address 2, you will get a seg fault. But it doesn't matter because this doesn't access memory, it just computes an address that we never read from, and we're just using that to taking advantage of how the address is computed to multiply by 5. Yes?
We could define the offsets,
yes, so the question is, can you do offsets? Absolutely. So like here, we did an offset in my first example.
We could also do negative offsets.
The question is, can you also do negative offsets? I believe so. Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, I believe the offsets are signed numbers. I'm not actually sure, but they won't assemble if you can't. Like your assembler will say, sorry, there's no instruction like this. Or if your offset is too big. There's some limit on the size of the offset, which I think is 32 bits. And it might give you an error for that. So another notable thing is that because we have an address computation which adds two numbers, we can use LEA as a 3-register add instruction. So ordinarily, if I wanted to add RBX and RCX into RDX, I would need two instructions. I would need to move one of them into RDX and then do an add. But with LEA, I can do that in one instruction and still have my old values of RBX and RCX lying around. And you will see compilers do both of these things because it's convenient, saves space, and works. So any questions on any of the examples here?
So the core purpose of LEA is what again?
The idea is that we have this stuff to compute addresses, and it's useful for more than computing addresses. Let's make it easily available to the compiler if they just want to compute an address or just want to do math. So it's just another arithmetic instruction that happens to reuse the machinery that move implements that takes up a lot of space in the processor, presumably. Okay, so a quick exercise. What's this? You can talk amongst yourselves. So as a note, first odd thing is that this LEAL, so like move, you can have a 32-bit version, so that does a 64-bit address computation, then only uses the bottom 32 bits to store into EAX. So what is this mystery function? This is actual compiler output. So what it was in the dot, 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 probably. So people need more time. Okay. Okay, so people aren't talking much, so I'll assume you either have an idea or you don't. So who thinks it's A, probably? B, C, D, a couple people, E, a couple people, F, one person. Who wants to defend their answer, whatever it is? Okay. So the arg is an RDI, so this is arg, okay.
And then we add that to 0 because it is empty at the comma.
Yeah.
So the base is 0.
Mm-hmm.
And then we multiply by 8 because the scalar is 8. And then we move that and then we add an offset of 0. So the answer is k times r z, and we move that into the a x.
Okay.
So that gives us a times r in the a x.
Okay.
And we subtract what's in the a I, which is also r.
Mm-hmm. So arg minus, and you said 8 times arg. Other way.
Wait, so the thing about sub, is it the thing on the right subtracting?
Subtract from, yes. So we take EAX, which is we established was 8 times arg. Yeah, I was writing it wrong.
Okay.
And subtract arg. Yes, so we get 7 times arg, which is none of the above. So the first step multiplies times 8, the second step subtracts the arg once to make it be multiplying times 7. Yes?
Since RDI is used, even though it's in a 32-bit instruction, but it is used, so should it be long arg?
So the question is, we're using RDI, why isn't it long arg? So, because this is an address computation, we have to use 64-bit registers in the address part. But we're truncating the result to 32 bits, and we know that setting a 32-bit register actually clears the top bits, and that's why it's okay to do this.
Doesn't that affect the sign?
It turns out for multiplication it doesn't matter, but that is not obvious indeed, and I should, it's not obvious, and you are reasonable to think that maybe there's some corner case where this gets it wrong, but it turns out that this is that right, just because our compiler was really careful about making sure it worked. That multiplication, when it overflows, it doesn't do it in a way which is bad even for signed multiplication. Okay, so that's that example. Any questions on this before I move on? Okay, so some actual review. So let's talk about the calling convention. This should all be review. Hopefully you remember it. So on a 64x86, we have a whole bunch of registers, which we've just arbitrarily chosen on Linux, or where arguments go in some order. And we use the size of register based on the size of the argument. We have a long, we use RDI, if we have an int, we use EDI, and so on. The rest go on the stack. The return value goes in REX. And you don't need to memorize this. There's a figure in the book. You should refer to it if you need to know. So, and you've probably seen before. So typically, when you see a function call, there will be some work to move all the arguments into the appropriate registers. Then there will be a call. And then something will probably use EAX, the return value, if there is a return value. So any questions on this basic calling convention stuff? So hopefully this is familiar from 2150. If not, you should review it or ask questions. Other thing is call and ret. So remember that call pushes the address of the next instruction on the stack and then jumps. Return pops that address that probably was pushed by call, but maybe you got there some other way, from the stack, and then jumps there. So that's what those instructions do. So that means that on the stack, there's always return addresses because these are the instructions we have in x86. So the other part of our calling convention that I didn't mention is the callee error, callee saved. So we've just defined arbitrarily that functions will preserve certain registers. So for example, when we call a function, we expect the stack pointer to be the same when it returns. So the function is responsible for making sure that happens. Same is true for RBX, RBP, and R12 through R15. This is what Linux decided functions should do. So that means that if you want to use R12 in a function, you typically will do something like push it onto the stack and then pop the old value later. So the caller, as far as they're concerned, you never changed R12, even though you actually did, because you restored its old value. And when you want to preserve a value that a function might change, like R11, you could push it onto the stack and pop it later, or do something else to make sure that the function doesn't mess with it, that you get the value back after the function possibly changes it. So any questions on this?
Can you go back to the other side of the list of which ones?
Yeah. This is also in your textbook. You do not need to memorize it.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, so another little exercise. As long as we're talking about pushing and popping on the stack, which hopefully is review from 2150. What is value here? And you can talk amongst yourself. We'll give you like a minute. And yes, this would be a good problem to write things down if you aren't doing that. But you can do it in your head, that's fine. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, not too many. So who thinks the answer is A? Okay, B. Okay, C. Okay, D. One E. Okay, a couple F. Okay, anyone want to defend their answer? Okay, apparently not, so I'll just do... So we have our stack. So we have our RSP initially pointing here, and then we push one here, and then RSP now points here, and this is a distance of 8 because we're pushing an 8-byte value. And then we push 2. And remember that this is lower addresses because the stack grows down on x86. And now the stack pointer points here, and we add 8 to the stack pointer. So RSP points to the beginning of 2, and 8 plus RSP points to the beginning of 1. And we're adding the constant 3 to the value at that location in memory, since destination is last. So we take this 1, and it becomes 4. And then we pop the value at the stack pointer into RAX. So this goes into RAX, and this goes into the next thing popped into RBX. So the answer is A. Any questions about that?
Why did they add to the top one?
Why did they add to the top one? So our stack pointer, when we did the add, was pointing at the beginning of the value 2. And since the stack grows down, 8 bytes above that is the previous thing on the stack. 8 bytes plus that is the previous thing on the stack. So that's that value 1. And that's what the destination of the add was. Yes?
For review, break down the syntax of the second part of the add statement after the comma.
This What do you mean the syntax of this?
The after the comma, what each like a and then what the parentheses there with the
percent. So this says, so in sudo c, this is memory at 8 plus the value in RSP plus equals 0x3. Is that clear? Okay.
If our system was in big endian, would 3 be added to 2?
The question is, does the endianness matter? No. Because it's still an 8-byte value, and we just interpret everything as differently, but we'd still have a 3 being added to that 8-byte value, which was now just stored in a different order. But we would have stored like 1 and 2 in a different order too, yeah, and also added them as if they were in the big endian order. Other questions? Okay, so one final note on assembly stuff that you might see in the lab and homework. There's this thing called RIP. So RIP represents the address of the next instruction. IP stands for instruction pointer. It kind of looks like a register, but you can't move to it. But there's one special case where you're allowed to use it, which is in move instructions of this form, where you use it to compute an address. So this means add 500 to the address of the next instruction, access memory there, and put the result in REX. And compilers will sometimes generate this sort of thing. In assembly, you can write label parentheses RIP, and you would think that that would take the address of label, add it to the address of the next instruction, and access memory there, but it's a weird special case, and it doesn't do that. Instead, it acts like label, just plain label without any register thing. But it actually uses the machine code that's based on the next instruction address. So it uses a move that doesn't contain the absolute address, but contains an offset from the next instruction. And there are reasons related to linking that we're not going to go into this course, why compilers sometimes prefer to generate that instruction, and we'll do this. And you might see assembly, which is designed to generate that instruction. But you might see this in your BOM lab. We're not going to test you on it, but I'm just mentioning it so you know what's RIP. Now you know it's the address of the next instruction, and it's commonly used when compilers want machine code that is based on that and not based on absolute addresses. And there's a special assembly syntax for generating the offset, which doesn't look like it should, given what I told you. So that's everything I'm going to talk about, and yes?
You mentioned a BOM lab?
Yes, the lab that is tomorrow, which you can start early, but the lab that is tomorrow, which has assembly in it. Yes. So things we won't cover today, so floating point or vector operations, haven't told you anything about how that works. There's a whole other set of registers for them that we haven't talked about. We'll talk about vector operations much later in the semester, and you'll learn what that even means. We haven't talked about segmentation, so there are these other special registers, DS, FS, GS, that we also won't be talking about. That might come up. Some assembly code you see. Not going to deal with that in this course. And of course, x86 has like 2,000 instructions, and we haven't shown you most of them, and won't. So if you ever need to look something up about x86, there's the official manual. This is written like for operating system and compiler writers, but it has all the information you could want. It's the authoritative source. Like if you actually need to know, it's in there. It's a little big, as you can see by combined volumes 1, 2A, 2B, 2C, 2D, 3A, 3B, 3C, 3D. Yeah, not a compact thing, but it has all the information. On the calling convention, so in Linux, the calling convention is formally defined by this standard document, which again is written for a compiler writer, so it's not the friendliest reading, but if you want to look up, for example, how do floating point numbers get passed to functions? What happens for functions which take variable number of arguments? Things like that, that's all in this document. All the cases that aren't handled by use these registers. Okay, so that's all I have on assembly. Let's talk we're gonna move into so translating C to assembly and how some things you've used in assembly actually work, most notably comparisons. But first, talk about something in C and C++, which is GoTo. So GoTo is a feature in C and C++ you probably haven't used. And this example shows you probably the most widely like use of GoTo, which is that you want to break out of nested loops. Hey, you can actually do it. And this basically translates into a label. You can write a label and see, yes, that is a real thing that exists in C and C++, and you can jump to it. So GoTo in C and C++ is only allowed within a function, but it does work basically like you'd imagine it being translated to assembly. So any questions? Syntax clear enough? Yeah.
What do you mean it has to
be a method? So if you, I can't put found in some other function and then go to it. That is not allowed. And it makes sense because like there's questions of what about my local variables? What happens to them? Things like that.
So they have to be like in the same scope?
They don't have to be in the same scope, like because like this is not quite the same scope, but they have to be in the same function. And weird things might happen if you like skip over variable declarations. So I'm mentioning this because this is closer to assembly and will be nice for talking about things like, how do I translate this to assembly? And you know that's a task we're going to want you to be able to do. And the general procedure I'm going to use for something like this is I'm going to say, I'm going to translate it into first into C code that is easier to translate into assembly. So I will write C code up where each line is a normal C expression without flow control, or if GoTo or just GoTo. And I know how to write if B is less than 42, GoTo in assembly. That's a compare and a jump, and a conditional jump. I know how to write GoTo after else. That's just a jump. So this is now very straightforward, relatively mindless to translate into assembly. And so if we ask you to translate an if statement into assembly, this is sort of general pattern use. And you, if you practice doing this, you'll memorize patterns like this. Like if you have if else, typically you have something to skip over the then part to go to the else, and something to skip over the else part. That's usually a pattern you get used to. But the way you can know you're doing the right thing is by first writing in C. You could just go directly to assembly and figure it out that way, but I usually find that very error prone and annoying. So once I have that, I can just translate it, just line by line, each line, this thing, each line is translated to assembly one at a time. And that's how you got equivalent assembly that way. So any questions on this procedure? Everyone feel like, if we gave you this on an exam, you might be able to do it, maybe. What? Okay. So, yeah. So, that's simple case. So the general pattern we're going to use is we're going to just translate this into code without if, else, while, and so on, just with if GoTo as the only sort of control flow construct in GoTo. Because those are the things you have in assembly, and they actually exist in C. So like, if you were doing this on a computer, you could make sure the C actually does the right thing before you keep going. So how about a loop? So here I have a do while loop. And I chose a do while loop because this is going to be the simplest possible thing to translate to assembly as a loop. So the first step I'm going to do, again, is I'm going to want to translate this to that C code with no sort of loop. I'm just going to use if, GoTo, and GoTo. And in this case, we want to just execute this first instruction, set x to 99, execute foo, x minus minus, and then if x is greater than 0, you want to do it again. So that's just one simple if GoTo. We need a label for the start of the loop. And that's this sort of pseudo assembly C code we get. And then we can translate that into actual assembly code. So any questions on this? So one thing you may notice is I'm saying here that we compute R12 minus 0. And that seems like a kind of weird thing. So we're going to talk a bit about how comparisons actually work today and also on Thursday. And you just probably, in 2150, kind of thought of compare and conditional jump as a pair of instructions that you have to keep together, but that's not how they work. So the compare instruction sets some special registers known as condition codes. And condition codes store information about the last arithmetic result. They store, is it zero, is it negative, and so on. So what the compare instruction does is it does a subtraction, computes a result, and only sets condition codes. Then the jump instructions look at them. So for example, we have our conditional jump instructions are named based on the result of subtraction. So if you do compare 0 RAX, RAX minus 0 is computed. And then we look at the result of that to figure out what the jump does. So jump equal asks, was the result 0? Was 0 equal to 0? 0 minus 0 would be 0. And so that would mean if we did that comparison, then jump equal, we would jump. Jump not equal says, is it not 0? Jump less than says, was it negative? And so on. So we're just doing a subtraction and storing whether the result was 0 and the sign of the result. And we're using that information in order to direct future jumps. And we've only done this setting these condition codes in 2150 probably with the compare instruction, maybe the test instruction. But they're actually set by almost every arithmetic operation. So any questions so far? I'll go through some examples. Yeah.
Where exactly is this number stored with the arithmetic?
So the question is, where are these stored? So there is a special register that you cannot name in assembly directly, called the condition codes that store this information. They don't actually store the arithmetic result. We'll talk next time about what they actually store, but they store enough information so that jump greater than, jump less than, jump equal can work.
So how does it work with add, if you're adding stuff, not doing
that? We store information about the results, and it just happens that when you do an add, the interpretation does not match the naming convention. But it stores the same thing. So I'll start with the simple example. So for example, if we do move negative 10 into RAX, 20 into RBX, then we subtract negative 10 from 20, which gives us 30. That's our result. That's positive, so it's greater than 0. So jump less than equal is going to test it was the result less than or equal to 0, and it's not going to jump. And I computed 30. Doesn't change the sign. So that's generally how they work. Notice I don't need a compare instruction. And when you recompile or generate a code, it often won't use one. It will just do a subtraction and happens to produce the right result for its conditional jump. And so comp is actually just like subtraction, except it forgets to store the result in the destination register. Otherwise, it does everything subtraction does. So that's how compare works. And the test instruction, have you seen test before in 2150? Okay, some people, so you might see it. It does a bitwise and. We'll talk about what that is sometime later in the semester. The most important case it's used in is that you might see test RAX, RAX, or something like that. The result it computes is RAX. So if you do test RAX, RAX, and RAX was 0, then jump equal will say, yes, the result was equal to 0. If your result is like 10, jump greater than will say, yes, the result was greater than 0. Because the result is just the value in RAX, and compilers will sometimes use that instead of a compare instruction. So it's basically equivalent to comparing to 0. Okay. I guess we'll. So we're used to this sort of case where we don't do a subtract, we do a compare. So this acts exactly the same as what I showed you earlier with the subtract, except we don't clobber RBX with the value. Yeah?
Where's the result of that?
So the condition code is our special registers that are in addition to the general purpose registers. They don't have a name in assembly. They're just used by the conditional jump instructions, but they're extra registers stored in the same place as like RAX.
Oh, okay, so the only information I would hold on to after the operation is the sign.
The sign and whether it was zero, yes. Okay, so we'll finish this up next time. The preview is that loop I showed you earlier, we can omit that compare and just use this subtraction result.